KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education in Psychology, offering a master's in clinical psychology with an MFT. Priority deadline to apply for September classes is May 28th. gsep.pepperdine.edu.
From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take Two. I'm Amy Martinez. Hope you're having a terrific Monday so far on this, the first full day of the reign of the new ruler of Westeros. You're going to have to find out on your own. I don't want people yelling at me on Twitter. All right, we got a lot of great stuff lined up today, so stay right here with us. We're going to be speaking with Heal the Bay about its latest river report card. Find out which of SoCal's popular freshwater recreation areas made the grade for safe water play. Plus, a couple of medievalists at the Getty Museum have been analyzing Game of Thrones through art and manuscripts and doing it all on social media. We'll get their take on how it all ended. That's coming up later in the show. But we're going to start with firefighter funding. Rain is in the forecast this week, but as we move into the dry season this summer, tensions are brewing between the U.S. Forest Service and local fire departments in the state. At the heart of the issue is a federal-state partnership called the California Fire Assistance Agreement. Brian Marshall is on the line to break it all down. He's the fire and rescue chief for the Governor's Office of Emergency Services. Brian, welcome to Take Two.
Thank you for having me.
Sure. Now, okay, a couple of things at play here. Let's start with the California Fire Assistance Agreement. What is it and how does it all work?
For decades, local government fire departments have had an agreement with Cal Fire and the U.S. Forest Service in order for them to respond and give assistance during wildland fires. This agreement spells out how they respond and, most importantly, the reimbursement process.
The reimbursement process. Okay, now this deal was inked in 2015. It's slated to expire at the end of the year. What's at the core of the tensions behind this partnership, and what does it mean if it expires?
Well, what we are discussing right now is last year's fire season and the amount of money owed to local government fire departments. Roughly $9 million are still to be paid from last summer. What we're trying to do is renegotiate the agreement at the same time. We cannot let this agreement expire and have no agreement in place. If you look back a couple of years ago, the Thomas Fire was burning at Christmas. That potential is still there. Fire season's year-round. And most importantly, this agreement is used for a multitude of other emergencies, not just wildland fires.
So, Brian, you said $9 million. That's what's at issue here.
That's what's remaining to be paid from last summer.
Okay. What can you do about that? I mean, if someone owes me money and they haven't paid, I would take them to court. Is that something that's an option for you?
Well, a local government fire department responded in good faith to a request from the U.S. Forest Service for assistance on a wildland fire. They responded under the current terms and conditions. The local government fire department was paying their employees while they were on that incident. So now, fast forward to May, you know, 6-9 months has gone by from these fires, and a local government fire department hasn't received their reimbursement. Now, local governments typically operate on a July 1st to June 30th fiscal year. Mm-hmm. They're getting ready to close out their books. And I've got to believe, because I was a local government fire chief, that a lot of fire departments, fire chiefs, they're being asked by their elected officials, how come they haven't received the reimbursement and they're operating in the red?
So what happens, though, in how firefighting costs pile up with this money not being there? What happens to just normal firefighting services?
Well, now you have a local government fire department that's in the red. That puts a fire chief's job in jeopardy. And it also makes elected officials and fire chiefs look at, can I financially respond to the next call for help?
We're talking to Brian Marshall. He's the fire and rescue chief for the Governor's Office of Emergency Services. Now, Brian, on the flip side, Forest Service is saying that local fire departments are overbilling. Could that be true?
There could be some truth of overbilling. We haven't seen any of that information. But there could also, as the Forest Service stated, there could be underbillings. We have not seen the documentation.
Really quick, Brian, going back to the lawsuit thing, I mean, is that something that you guys are considering, possibly?
I think everybody, the last thing on our minds is a lawsuit. We are negotiating right now the new agreement. We have meetings that have occurred. We have meetings that are scheduled. I am hopeful that we can resolve the issue, have a new California Fire Assistance Agreement in place by the end of the year. Again, this agreement is an all-hazard agreement, so we use this agreement for a multitude of different emergencies that local governments respond to. Also, fire season never ends in California. I would hate on January 1st to have a wildland fire and hands be tied due to an expired agreement.
So it's something that's not off the table then, just to be clear.
No, we are continuing to negotiate. We want an agreement. We need an agreement. It's the best thing for our citizens in the state of California. It's the best thing for the fire service. So we're hopeful that we can renegotiate an agreement. Now, what that agreement looks like in the future, we're not sure, but we have every intention to come to the table and negotiate in good faith.
All right, that's California Office of Emergency Services Fire and Rescue Chief Brian Marshall. Brian, thank you very much for taking the time.
Thank you.
All right, moving on. Senator and presidential hopeful Kamala Harris took aim at the gender pay gap Sunday.
When you lift up the economic status of women, you lift up the economic status of families and communities and all of society.
Now, nationwide, women still make 80 cents for every dollar paid to men. That gap widens for women of color. Harris's proposal would make larger companies meet new pay standards and would fine them 1% of their profits for every 1% difference in pay. So how might a proposal like this work here in California? We're going to get some answers from Rachel Van Sickle Ward. She's a professor of political studies at Pitzer College. Rachel, welcome back.
Great to be here, eh?
All right. I want to start off by just asking your reaction to this recent proposal by Senator Harris.
There's a lot of elements that I think are really interesting about it, and some have to do with the policy itself, and some are about the context at which she's introducing it. So a few things about the policy that are noteworthy. One is it really flips the script on who is responsible for providing evidence that there are pay disparities. So traditionally, if a pay disparity is identified, it's the individual woman who has to take that to court and try and make sure that she's compensated. So there are laws on the books that say that paying men more than women is illegal, but it's really on the individual woman in general to make sure that she gets that fair pay. What Harris's proposal does is say, no, the onus should be on the companies to demonstrate that they're paying their employees fairly. So it creates some oversight mechanism to make sure that that's happening. The other element about the policy I think is really interesting is that it ties more broadly into something she's been talking about a lot in terms of women's economic equality being about everybody's economic equality on balance. So as she talked about in that clip that you played, paying women fairly means that families are better off economically and that communities are better off economically. So she's really tying this in to a broader conversation about economic equality for women and for communities. And then the last thing I think is interesting is this comes on the heels of her proposal for better pay for K-12 teachers. And one way that we see economic disparities really affecting women is not just within individual jobs, but across industries. So lower paying jobs like teaching tend to be you know, jobs that are taken by women. No. And so she's really tackling this in a multi-pronged way.
Now, and imagine, Rachel, a lot of job hunters don't know the answer to the next question, but how is pay calculated in general? How do women end up at a disadvantage? And what really is equal work?
That's a great question. I mean, as you know, there's so much variation, right? So there's so many different types of jobs and industries. But on balance, it comes down to a calculus of what skills or assets does this individual bring to the table and how much are those worth? And on the flip side, you know, what's the minimum that an employer can get away paying them and still get them, right? What's going to prevent them from taking another job? And what we see is there's kind of gender disparities built into both sides of that equation. There's all sorts of ways that there's evidence that men's worth is believed to be higher for reasons that don't really bear out when you look at the metrics, but that are perceived to be the case
when
you're doing interviews. Well, for example, elements like talent or performance that are ambiguous but seem to be more associated with male traits. I'll just give you one example. When you're doing academic review, one thing you would think you would care about is teacher evaluations, right? That makes perfect sense. We care about how teachers are performing in the classroom. When you do studies of teacher evaluations, if you do, say, online classes and change the name of the gender of the teacher, but everything else is exactly the same, you see that there are disparities in how those evaluations happen, and those disparities tend to benefit the male candidates. So that's one part of the equation. And then the other part of the equation is in terms of how much it's going to take to pay someone to get them to take the job, you see gender bias built in there because women have historically made less money than men throughout their careers. And so when positions ask for something like pay history, women are going to have made less than men at their prior employment.
So if you're starting at a lower spot, even if you get a raise or get, it's still not as high as someone else.
The disparities end up getting exacerbated. So California has tackled this in some really important ways already by doing things like prohibiting asking salaries of your past jobs. But what Harris's bill does is say, we're going to make sure that the companies have a responsibility to be really careful in that calculus.
Talking to Rachel Van Sickle Ward, professor of political studies at Pitzer College. Now, here in California, there have been advances when it comes to workplace equality. In October, California became the first state to require publicly traded companies to have at least one woman on their board of directors. What does the pay gap look like here, and how do we compare to other states when it comes to equity on the job?
Well, you know, there's good news and bad news on that front. The good news, if you want to look at it this way, is compared to other states, we actually do quite well. We are, by some metrics, actually the highest performing state in terms of gender equity. The bad news is when you sort of push on those numbers, there's a lot that's going wrong. So even though we're ranked the highest, that still means that there's a median disparity of somewhere around $7,000. Men are being paid $7,000 more on balance than women. And then beyond that, if you look at the numbers for women of color, Latina women in this state make something like 43 cents on the dollar compared to white men. So it's pretty dismal. Even if we're ranked highest, that's actually in some ways kind of a sad commentary on how the country as a whole is doing.
Now, Rachel, what about this? Because when I was browsing through the comment sections on articles about this recent announcement by Kamala Harris, some common themes start to pop up. And people have said that it wouldn't be fair to require equal pay on jobs where physical strength is required. Some also argue that male candidates might make more money for a company. Is there any merit to those points?
You know, it's interesting. Whenever I think about the physical strength argument, I always think about how much physical strength it takes to take care of children, for example, or how much physical strength it takes to take care of someone who is elderly. And there actually is, if you look at caretaking jobs, a number of women doing physically very demanding work. We just don't compensate those jobs very well as an industry. But the second part to that question is, if the concern really is about performance, there actually is built-in performance exceptions to this, right? So you can pay individuals more who are performing better than other individuals. It's just challenging those companies to make sure that that difference is not entirely about gender. And then the other thing I think is important to think about is when you're looking at whether or not, so the second part of your question, whether you're looking at whether or not those individuals are going to bring in more or perform better, let's make sure we have really good metrics for making sure that's happening, and we're not defaulting to the sort of like stereotypes we talked about earlier, where we just assume that the male candidate is performing better because the metrics that we have are actually gender biased already.
Yeah, just because the job requires lifting boxes, that doesn't necessarily mean that every man will be able to do it better than every woman.
Right, exactly. So we tend to essentialize gender in some really problematic ways. We tend to assume that men are physically stronger than women, and there's so much variation within genders and across genders that really the metric should be about performance and not about an assumption that the male candidate will perform better by definition.
Now, last thing, Rachel, really quick, looking at this from a political perspective, Harris's campaign has had strong fundraising totals. She's still polling in the single digits, a very crowded Democratic field. We all know that. How much could her proposals targeting economic inequality help her in the primary?
You know, I think they're going to help in a couple of important ways. One is this issue pulls very well with Democrats. It actually pulls pretty well across parties, but it pulls especially well with Democratic voters. So since we're in the primaries, I think an issue that really gets Democratic voters excited about our candidacy is a great idea. But more specifically for her, this really reinforces some elements that she's been highlighting on the campaign trail for a while. So for example, she said frequently in interviews and on the stump that she thinks that how we talk about civil rights is about American identity, right? So she's pushed back on some critiques of so-called identity politics by saying, no, if women are being mistreated, if people of color are being mistreated, we need to have policies that respond to that. So when we think about candidacies as sort of reinforcing a brand, I think this serves her very well from a policy perspective, but also for a strategic perspective.
Rachel Van Sickle Ward is professor of political studies at Pitzer College. Rachel, thanks a lot.
Great to be here.
All right, Memorial Day is next week. Summer starts in a month. That means it's getting to be that time to get your freshwater recreation vacay on. Now, before you go chasing local water holes, those rivers and lakes that you're used to might be moving too fast with bacteria. Find out the spots where you can either play your way or maybe do nothing at all. That's coming up in 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. Today, Heal the Bay released its annual report card on water quality in LA's freshwater recreation areas. Now, the river report card looks at bacterial pollution at 27 sites in the LA River, Malibu Creek, and San Gabriel River watersheds to determine their safety, assigning them color grades of red, yellow, or green. Red, of course, being the highest risk of getting sick. With the area's freshwater recreational areas opening up this Memorial Day weekend, we thought we'd get some detailed information on the results with Shelley Luce. She's CEO of the environmental nonprofit Heal the Bay. Shelley, welcome to Take Two.
Thank you.
All right, let's start with the good news. More than half of the freshwater recreation sites Heal the Bay tested got a green report card, meaning they're safe. Which of the 27 areas that you tested had the cleanest water?
Well, that is great news. There were at least six sites that got a perfect score, and that means they got green grades 100% of the time all summer long. Four of them are in the Upper San Gabriel River. They're the Upper North Fork, Upper East Fork, and two sites around Cattle Canyon. And two more sites in the Upper LA River also got perfect scores.
Ooh.
At Hermit Falls and Big Tahunga.
All right.
We also saw really good grades at a few other sites, including in the Sepulveda Basin Recreation Area. So that's great news for kayakers there.
Yeah, that's absolutely great news. Now, one thing real quick, in the Health the Bay report, the freshwater sites in more natural areas tend to earn better grades than freshwater sites near development. Why is that in particular?
Yeah, that's true. And that's because our urban areas are the source of the pollution that can make people sick. The runoff is the water that flows over our streets and paved areas and parking lots. It picks up pollutants, including bacteria and viruses, and washes them into the storm drains that end up in our rivers. We don't have that up in our national forests that we're so lucky to have, all that nature so close to our city. So swimming in the rivers and swimming holes up in the national forests is much safer. They're much cleaner.
All right, so we had some good news there. Now let's get to the bad news. Your group's river report card included a top 10 freshwater fails list. So tell us which place got the top spot and why.
The dirtiest site was at Hanson Dam up in the valley, where 80% of the grades were in the red zone. So that means high risk of getting sick. there's a lot going on at this site, so we'd have to do some more investigating to find out exactly why the scores were so low. But in the meantime, there are a lot of people gearing up after Memorial Day for fishing and boating and kayaking on this lake. So what we want to do is make sure they know the risk of water contact when they're there.
Yeah, Hanson Dam was just in the news last week. 20 lifeguards got sick after swimming in the water. What more can you tell us about what happened there and what city officials are doing to make sure the water is safe this summer?
Those lifeguards encountered a parasite commonly known as swimmer's itch, and it is associated with fecal matter, more from birds and wildlife than from people, but this is exactly why we test for fecal indicator bacteria. When levels of the fecal indicator bacteria are high, we know that there is likely to be those other pathogens in the water that can make people sick. So again, we have to provide that information for people who are going to use our waterways.
And is that typically one of the big causes of why there are higher bacteria levels in any given body of freshwater?
Yeah, it's coming from fecal matter, from people, pets, sometimes birds and wildlife. It can be a variety of sources.
How much does extreme weather and the rain factor into that? Because it's been a really wet winter, so I'm wondering if there's any connection there.
Well, there is a connection in that every time it rains, we get a lot more runoff, including a lot more viruses and bacteria into our waterways. However, the testing that we're talking about only occurred during dry weather. So we only tested, and the other entities whose data we collect are only testing during the summer season and when it has not been raining.
Talking to Shelley Luce, CEO of Heal the Bay. Shelley, tell us more about how this report card is put together. How often does Heal the Bay test local waterways, and what exactly are you looking for?
We test once a week, all summer long.
Okay.
Yeah, at six different sites, four in the LA River recreational areas where people are fishing and kayaking, and two in Malibu Creek State Park, where a lot of people go to swim. We test for two different bacteria, E. coli and Enterococcus, because both of these bacteria are found in fecal matter and are indicators of pathogens like viruses that you'll find in the water when those bacteria are present. The other sites in our report that we talked about already, the upper San Gabriel River and other upper LA River sites, are tested by other groups, including the city, the county, and other environmental groups, and we collect their data and incorporate them into our report card.
You mentioned you test once a week. It's good to know that you test that often, but wondering how much do things change week to week?
Bacteria can vary a lot. So the more testing we could have, the better, of course. So that's why we get out there to add to the testing that's already ongoing. And also, we need to make sure that we're testing for the right thing. So Heal the Bay is testing for E. coli and Enterococcus. Other entities are only testing for E. coli. And what we actually found is that if you only test for one bacterium, you get green grades more often. So we're missing that other bacteria, that other indicator that might be a better indicator of how risky it actually is to get in the water.
So, Shelley, what do you recommend then for people who want to swim, wade, fish, or kayak in LA's freshwater recreational areas this summer? I mean, how can they make sure the water is safe before they jump in and maybe experience something terrible?
I recommend you go to healthebay.org and check out our report card, because we'll be posting these grades every week. And when you see a history of always getting green grades, then you can be assured that as long as it hasn't been raining, it's probably safe for you to swim. And also, pay attention to signs that are posted at the LA River recreational zones. The city is now beginning a program of posting when high bacteria levels are present.
Shelley, what do you say, though, to someone that's listening and thinking, oh, man, I don't even want to go experience any of this stuff, so I'll just stay out of the water completely?
I say don't stay out of the water completely. Definitely go for a hike, go kayaking. Just make sure that you're only going when it has not been raining and that you're choosing the sites that are getting those green grades.
Shelley Luce is CEO of Heal the Bay. We've been speaking with her about the nonprofit's annual River Report Card, which rates freshwater recreation areas in the LA River, Malibu Creek, and San Gabriel River watershed. Shelley, thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, turning to the streets now. Los Angeles and much of California got another beating from the rain this weekend. And since we know that all that weather can damage roads, causing cracks and creating potholes, we thought we'd check in on how the city is doing with repairs. Keith Mose is assistant director for the Los Angeles Bureau of Street Services and oversees the pavement program. Keith, welcome to Take Two.
Hello. How are you?
Good, good. Now, the last time we checked in with your department, it was a struggle to keep up with all the potholes here in L.A. The constant rain was creating so many of them. What's the situation now? Is it any better?
It is better, actually. By the end of the month, we'll have caught up and gone back to our normal three-day turnaround time. Just to give you some numbers, from January 1st, 2019 to May 20th to present, we closed and completed 19,682 potholes through our 311 service request system. During the same period last year, from January 2018 to May 20th, 2018, we closed 9,641 pothole requests. That's 10,000 fewer than last year.
Wow, I didn't realize it was that many. 19,000 is a heck of a lot. Were you expecting that many?
No, but unfortunately, as you know, as it rains, it causes considerable damage to our roads.
Now, okay, so the cost of repairing the roads has increased as much as 30% in some California cities. What are you seeing in L.A., and what's driving those increases?
Well, basically, we have seen a cost increase in trucking, oil, and raw aggregates, what's used to make asphalt materials. And so basically, that's a significant increase. As oil prices rise, things like that, we do see those costs increase from vendors.
So it's just a simple thing of just materials are getting more expensive.
Yes.
Yeah. Now, how much do those increases then eat into your overall budget for repairs?
Well, basically, it varies depending on trucking or oil. It will vary between the different vendor sources. And so it becomes a cumulative effect to where basically it can eat into our cost to perform and do these repairs. And possibly, you know, we just come up with different budget plans to basically account for that so we basically can keep up with the cost to repair streets, fix potholes, and provide services.
Now, I know that L.A. has a new asphalt plant. How can that maybe help offset some of the costs?
Well, basically, we're rebuilding our new municipal asphalt plant in our downtown area. It will be able to produce 400 tons of asphalt. And what's good about it, we'll be using recycled asphalt mix, a reclaimed asphalt pavement. And this will reduce our cost significantly as we'll have to purchase less raw materials.
Keith, is this almost like a game of whack-a-mole where it's like no matter what you do, you fix a pothole here, another one pops up somewhere else? It's one of those things that there's no way ever that you'll ever be able to be caught up, not because you're not trying, but because it's going to be really difficult.
Well, basically, streets are designed to shed water, but unfortunately, cracks introduce, you know, water into the different layers, and it gets trapped and therefore causing the potholes. But we are designing a stakeholder-driven planning process to develop a street renewal plan for the city of Los Angeles, basically to increase our streets in good condition to 75% by the year 2025.
All right. Keith Mose is the assistant director for LA's Bureau of Street Services. He's been talking with us about the state of pothole repair in the city. Keith, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Chugging, got my chips cashed in. Keep chugging, like the dude of man.
Southern California Edison launched a $356 million program today that will help fund the infrastructure necessary to recharge heavy-duty battery electric trucks.
We have the worst air quality in the country, and medium and heavy-duty vehicles contribute quite a bit to smog-forming pollutants.
That's Katie Sloan, director of e-mobility for the utility. Now, she says the program Charge Ready Transport aims to get about 870 charging sites up and running over the next 5 years, enough to let 8,500 battery electrics keep on trucking. Now, this week on Take Two, we'll take a closer look at zero emissions trucks, starting with a new pilot program at the Port of Los Angeles, where 18,000 trucks operate. Project Portal is a collaboration involving Toyota and the truck maker Kenworth and uses hydrogen to fuel a small electric fleet. The Los Angeles area is ground zero for big changes happening in shipping as transport trucks transition from diesel. We'll tell you all about these clean, green trucks right here on Take Two. All right, we know about all the migrants that are coming to the U.S.-Mexico border recently, many of them seeking asylum. Some head over to Texas, to the Rio Grande Valley area, but now some of those are being sent to California. We'll tell you why and what's being done to accommodate them when Take 2 continues. Stay with us.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering a doctorate of education in organizational leadership, developing graduates with the knowledge and ability to transform organizations for optimal success and growth, an online hybrid tailored for working professionals with attendance only twice per term in West LA. Attend an information session to learn more. Classes start in September. Apply by May 28th for a $1,500 scholarship opportunity at gsep.pepperdine.edu.
Sunny. Yesterday my life was filled with rain. Sunny. You smiled at me and really eased the pain. Now the dark days are done and the bright days are here. My sunny one shines so sincere. Sunny one so true, I love you.
Sunny. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm A. Martinez. Thousands of Central American migrants have reached the U.S.-Mexico border in recent months, many of them seeking asylum. And most have congregated near the Rio Grande Valley in Texas. But there are so many that starting just a few days ago, planes carrying hundreds of them are landing in California. They're being transferred to our state and processed at Border Control near San Diego instead. Reporting on this story is Kate Morrissey for the San Diego Union-Tribune. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
All right, now tell us about how and why the crowds put such a strain on the Border Control in Texas.
What they're saying is that the Border Patrol holding cells are beyond capacity. For example, the percent they cited was like 200% over capacity at one of the stations at the Rio Grande Valley. And so they're having to put people in places that they don't normally hold people. And they're trying to go through Border Patrol processing. But as they're doing that, they're having more come in before they're able to get everyone out of there. And so it's creating sort of this increased group of people that they can't hold in their facilities.
When migrants come to San Diego, what happens to them during processing?
They arrive here on an airplane. They are taken on buses to a Border Patrol station. They're held in holding cells there while they wait for their turn to be processed. They have their picture taken. They have their fingerprints taken. They're interviewed by agents to determine, you know, their basic biographical information, that sort of thing. And then if they are making some kind of asylum claim, then they would be put forward into the immigration system for that process. Once Border Patrol is done with them, they're transferred to ICE, and ICE makes a determination of whether the individual will be held in custody or whether they'll be released while they go through the immigration system.
So, Kate, when it comes to Border Patrol agents, how are they going to handle the influx without getting just completely overwhelmed?
We actually had fewer people crossing the border here in April than we did in March. So San Diego is actually seeing a little bit of a decrease right now. It could be that their decision to come here might have something to do with the fact that there is that little bit of wiggle room here that we were processing more just a month prior.
We're talking to Kate Morrissey for the San Diego Union-Tribune. Now, there are no family detention centers in California, and I stopped a program to help these migrants find family members in the U.S. who would be willing to take them in. So after people are processed, what happens to them?
So assuming that ICE determines that they're going to be released into the U.S. while they wait, they're given ankle monitors, and then they're generally taken to a shelter that was set up here towards the end of last year when ICE stopped that program that you mentioned. So the shelter is run by the San Diego Rapid Response Network. It's a collective of many local nonprofits that are somehow involved in immigrant rights advocacy or taking care of different groups of immigrants. And so they've all come together and put this shelter together. They've gotten a lot of support from local officials. The county of San Diego actually helps them find a more permanent home and a building that they're getting from the county through the end of the year. The governor of California has also given grant money to these organizations to be doing the work that they're doing.
Wondering, what have you heard from outreach organizations like the ones you mentioned about their ability to handle more people?
They've basically said that they're going to keep doing the work that they're doing. They're ready for it. The thing is that people don't stay in the shelter for very long. They're usually gone within a day or a couple of days because they have family or friends or someone in the U.S. who is willing to take care of them as they go through the immigration system. And so one of the things that the shelter does is help them connect with that person so that they can get bus or plane tickets purchased and get on their way to their final destination.
What about other organizations elsewhere in California, like L.A. or Northern California, maybe assisting with this influx of people?
So there are branches of some of the organizations here in San Diego and other parts of California. There's also a number of different organizations that are watching for arrivals locally. You know, I've heard from people even out in east of L.A. that they're trying to support one of the local shelters, I think, in the Coachella area. Mm. So there are things happening in other parts of the state, but a big bulk of the work is here in San Diego, which I think is evidenced in the way the grant was written from the governor when he was looking to fund some of this work.
And one more thing, when it comes to the planes of migrants that are coming to California, is that an indefinite situation right now?
Yes, they are saying this is indefinite. It's a contingency plan. It's going to happen while it's needed and while it's able to happen with the capacity here.
All right, Kate Morrissey is a reporter for the San Diego Union-Tribune. Kate, thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, now to a quick update. Last week, we talked to you about the low turnout for the special LA Unified School Board election last week. That's the District 5 election that Jackie Goldberg won. Well, the official numbers are in, and man, was it really low, even by LAUSD standards. Election officials said Friday that just 8.7% of registered voters turned out. But low turnout may be only a symptom of a deeper problem. KPCC's Kyle Stokes explains.
An LAUSD board seat represents almost as many voters as a U.S. House district, but school board candidates only have a fraction of the campaign budget. So here's where political scientists say a vicious cycle begins. Campaigns use data to find voters who've turned out most reliably in past elections, and then they target those voters. In LAUSD's Board District 5, that's in neighborhoods like Los Feliz and Eagle Rock, whiter and higher income than the rest of the district. So who's getting ignored? Lewis Myers, who did consulting work for four campaigns in the recent election, says it's probably a voter from a low-income, majority Latino area of the district where turnout is lower.
He will never vote because he has never been engaged, and we will never engage him because he never votes.
That's KPCC's Kyle Stokes reporting. And by the way, political scientists say turnout is certain to improve the next LAUSD election, which will coincide with the March 20th presidential primary. All right, now that it's over, how will you satisfy your Game of Thrones cravings? Well, get it at the Getty. That's ahead when Take Two continues in 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. At last, our watch has ended. Although Game of Thrones show finale aired last night, there are more ways to keep its fantasy-inspired spirit alive. Curators at the Getty Museum have been connecting medieval art to each episode of the final season via Instagram TV.
We also talked about Eleanor of Aquitaine.
Certainly, and she's one of these extraordinary women who, she's from a wealthy family, certainly,
right.
Privileged already, but she marries a king. Mm-hmm. And
after
so,
having divorced a previous
exactly.
king, so she has agency.
Exactly.
In a way that we don't
see. But she's sort of, she takes power in a way that we don't necessarily think of women doing in the Middle Ages.
That was the medievalist behind the series Getty of Thrones, Larissa Grillemond and Brian C. Keene. You might want to pull up their Instagram and check out the manuscripts and arts they've profiled at the Getty Museum, because Larissa and Brian are here to tell us about the series, their series, and the influence of medieval art on the creators of the cultural phenomenon that is, or actually was at this point, Game of Thrones. Larissa and Brian, welcome to Take Two.
Thanks so much for having us.
All right, now, first off, this is a spoiler alert for fans who did not watch last night. I don't want to get all kinds of angry emails and tweets. But Larissa, Brian, how did you guys feel about the show's final episode?
Well, I think we were both a little bit disappointed because, of course, we're sad that it's coming to an end. But, of course, we're, you know, always a little bit sad to see our favorite characters kind of go off on their various journeys and not together in a lot of cases.
But I will say that Larissa and I, as sort of avid fans of the book and the show, accurately predicted who would be on the Iron Throne.
Did you really?
Yeah, we did. We were actually both right in a couple of different cases.
Because
so.
Vegas also had this person as the favorite. I'm still trying to pretend like I'm not going to say who it is, but he was the... Well, there you go. I said a he, so I'm giving a hint already. But he was the Vegas favorite, the person who wound up being the person in charge. Going
Indeed.
Forward, yeah.
I love this sort of character because he represents the memory of, you know, the Game of Thrones universe. So for us as historians of the Middle Ages, we're very grateful that this idea of memory continues on the non-existent Iron Throne.
All right, and just in case anyone doesn't want to know, here I'm going to say it. It's Bran. Bran is the new king of Westeros. So there you go. In case anyone's all upset, you can tweet me at amartinezla. So how did you two guys get familiar with the show? Did you guys read the books first, or how did that go for you guys?
Yeah, I think both of us were book readers initially, and it's one of those things that, you know, because all of our friends and families know that we're medievalists and we love medieval art, they're sort of our like, you know, you have to read this, you have to get into this, and I was a little reluctant at first, but I actually didn't start watching the show until around season two with the cries for me to watch it just became overwhelming, and then I immediately loved it and just thought, wow, this is going to be such a great thing for medieval studies.
Brian, what about you?
Ditto. It was the same having read the books, and I didn't catch on right away. My brother kept telling me, you know, you need to get into this series, and it was really, as Larissa said, the second series that I got into it, but really by the fourth season, we had just received so many emails and communications here at the Getty about, you know, what is real about this series, what, you know, what in the costumes or in the situations relates to the actual Middle Ages. So we finally decided to take the bull by the horns, do a series of blog posts, and have really evolved with social media over the years, from Facebook to Tumblr and now Instagram, which has proven to be extremely popular.
Now, so speaking of your series, have you been surprised by any of the feedback you've gotten from it?
We've actually been really surprised by the depth of engagement that people really have with the series, because people are really curious about, you know, what from Game of Thrones is based in the Middle Ages and what's being made up. And even things like dragons have roots in the Middle Ages. And so we've been able to really take our collection and show it to people, I think, in a different way.
And I've been really just impressed by, as Larissa says, that depth of knowledge, the questions that have forced us to go back to our own sort of chain libraries here at the Getty, as Samuel Tarley would have, to look at, you know, techniques of medieval shipbuilding, or instances of wildfire, or the role of women in power, or global trade networks in the medieval world, and how that relates to the rise and fall of kings and queens.
Talking to Larissa Grillemond and Brian C. Keene of Getty of Thrones. When it comes to Game of Thrones, the TV show, you guys aren't shy of criticizing it as far as its depiction of women, people of color, queer communities. Why do you guys think it's important to talk about these real topics in a show that's set in a very fantasy fictional world?
That's a great question, and it's one that we get a lot. And the Middle Ages, I think, have come down to us in a lot of different forms, and there are still lots of stereotypes about the Middle Ages. I think most people think of Western Europe, they think of Christianity, they think of these kind of monolithic parts of medieval life. And one of the things that we like to do is sort of take what people think they know about the Middle Ages and actually try to put it into historical context. And so it's been really, really important for us to kind of tell the untold stories of women and people of color and other kind of disenfranchised groups in the Middle Ages.
And we heard a phrase from a colleague.
I'm sorry, what was that, Brian?
Oh, no, I think he got cut off. I wasn't sure what the story he was going to tell was, but it has been, I think, really edifying for many people who do find a lot of fault with the kind of whiteness of Game of Thrones universe to really tell the stories that are untold thus far.
And that's one of the things, Larissa, right? Because a lot of people get their history, their actual history from Hollywood, and Hollywood doesn't care necessarily to get things right.
Exactly. So it's been, I think, important because Game of Thrones and other what we call medievalism, so things like Harry Potter and certainly video games and things like that, are kind of this amalgamation of all different kinds of myths of the Middle Ages. And people do really wonder, you know, what about this is accurate? And so we get a lot of questions about weaponry and warfare, for example, which we've seen on display in the Game of Thrones universe so much lately, especially. But even as I mentioned, things like dragons and magic and belief in herbal medicine, all of these kinds of things have roots in the Middle Ages. And so to be able to show people actual art and explain the history has been really cool because people are like, oh, you know, I didn't know about dragons or I didn't know that women actually ruled in the Middle Ages.
All right. So now that the show has ended, I know that there's going to be some other shows related to Game of Thrones coming up in the future. But now that this show has ended, how do you guys plan on continuing to engage the public?
I mean, I think we've been talking about that our collections have such potential to engage, you know, rich, diverse communities, to present a version of the Middle Ages that is multivocal and interconnected. We want to, as Larissa said, counter all these stereotypes of the Middle Ages. So whether it's a video game or another television or book series, we're confident that there's no shortage of themes that we can touch on to make the Middle Ages relevant. And as we found, the Middle Ages is relevant. People do care very much about the Middle Ages, whether it's a fact or fiction.
Exactly.
And one of the things, Larissa, that I noticed is that you take people's questions, right? People have questions in terms of comparisons. Compare the characters to people that actually may have existed in real life.
Yeah, so this is something we started doing with this latest season, really at the urging of one of our social media producers who's been involved with the project from the beginning. And she thought, you know, you should definitely see what people are thinking and see what they're curious about. And one of the things that we heard a lot of people ask about was women in the Middle Ages and what kinds of power did they hold? What kinds of social norms could they violate? Did they violate? And we've gotten really questions from across the board, all kinds of different aspects of medieval culture that, as Brian said, we've really had to delve deep into the collections and into new research to figure out the answers, which has been really fun for us.
Yeah, Brian, because that's one of the things you guys do anyway, right? You're going to be researching and reading all this stuff anyway. So to bring it up in the form of a question from someone that's interested in it, that's got to make you guys feel great.
Absolutely. As we say, it is the best kind of research for us possible to hear what do people think they know about the Middle Ages, what do they want to know, and how can we make sure that the work that we do in our galleries and online reflects that, since we are, you know, stewards to our communities. We are the maesters, right? We are the men to bring this material to the world.
You guys, one of you guys should change your name to Sam, I think.
Yeah, exactly. We're not trying to perform unauthorized surgeries out here, but we are trying to educate the public.
All right, one last thing. If listeners just can't wait a few years to get to the Game of Thrones spinoffs, how can they get their medieval cultural fix nearby?
Well, they can certainly come visit us at the Getty. We have two manuscript-related shows, medieval-related shows. There's The Wondrous Cosmos, which looks at the heavenly luminaries and astrology in the Middle Ages, and The Book of Beasts, The Bestiary in the Medieval World, which has all sorts of favorites, including dragons and any number of other creatures from the Middle Ages.
All right, that's Larissa Grolemond and Brian C. Keene, medievalists with the Getty Museum, talking to us about their Instagram TV series, Getty of Thrones. It looks at the pop culture phenomenon Game of Thrones through the lens of medieval art and manuscripts. Larissa, Brian, thank you very much for the time.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
All right, well, that show ended, but this show continues into the future. You can always find us on Twitter. We're @Take2. And if you want to yell at me for spoiling something, you could yell at me at @AMartinezLA. That's @AMartinezLA. We're going to be back tomorrow at 2. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. We'll talk to you then.